You believe things that are absolutely impossible. There is an event in the Scripture that you believe is true, no doubt, that has no basis in the physical laws of nature. Of course, that's what miracles are. They're the suspension of the laws of nature to provide something that God feels is important. Turn with me to John chapter 11. We're going to talk about a story today that really happened, a real life event, told in story form to teach us spiritual lessons. And it is important to remember that, frankly, this story is physically impossible. Couldn't have occurred without God's intervention. Now, there are things that are absolutely physically impossible on the physical realm, on the physical level. But when God is involved, we're no longer on the physical level. We're now on the spirit level. And things that are impossible in the physical become easily possible on the spiritual level. When God is involved, He can easily suspend and reverse and change the laws of physical matter to make things different. He did so here. Here in John chapter 11 is the story of Lazarus. Now, this is not the story of Lazarus and the rich man. That's a different story. That was a fictional story. This is a true recollection of actual events that took place. And of course, there is no subtitle to this one saying any resemblance to actual characters is completely by chance, or whatever that saying is that goes by in movies. It's not to mean, no, this is an actual story with people that experience this themselves. And we ask, with this story of Lazarus, you know the story. He dies, he's resurrected. What are we supposed to learn from this? Well, we're going to go through the story of Lazarus today to see what it is that God might want us to learn. Now, I'm going to challenge you this time to go ahead and write down lessons as we go along. Normally, what I seem to do is ask you to write down a lesson, and then we come to the point in the story that actually reinforces or maybe teaches that lesson. This time, what I'd like you to do, we're going to go through the story, and I'd like you to write down lessons that you learn along the way. And then when we get to the end, I'll tell you the ones that I think I learned going through the story again, and you can compare them to the ones that you've learned. And frankly, that's more important, because what you learn from it is really what's important to take home. So what do we learn from the events surrounding the life and death and resurrection of Lazarus of Bethany? Lazarus, as you know, is one of a trio of siblings. My guess is there was Martha, the oldest sister. Why do I think she's the oldest of the siblings? Because she's kind of bossy. Now, I have an older sister. Sorry, Debbie. And that's kind of the tendency that can take place. Then we have Lazarus, the brother. Obviously a very talented man, probably a good wage earner or an entrepreneur of some sort. They seem to have been pretty wealthy. And then you have Mary, the little sister, the spoiled sister. Okay, maybe not spoiled, but maybe not taking life's responsibilities as seriously as maybe her older sister would like her to. It didn't seem to help when Martha wanted to instruct her. And we can talk about that later. But nonetheless, let's pick up the story here with some background in John chapter 11 and verse 1. It says, "Now a certain man was sick." Now, how would you like to be introduced to the world as, hey, there's this guy that's sick? Now, I'm sure if I was Lazarus, I would like to say, there was this really sharp, intelligent, entrepreneurial, successful man by the name of Lazarus who just happened to get sick. But all we're told is here's this Lazarus of Bethany, and he's sick. "Certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha." Now again, I have some speculations here. Of course, teaching the Gospels, you study these a lot, and you wonder about various things that John included, maybe what he didn't include. But I'm guessing that by the time this story was written down by John, and we're talking 60 years or so maybe after the actual events took place, that he's writing this down and recording it, that they were more familiar with Mary and Martha than they probably were Lazarus. So he mentions it's a town where Mary and Martha were from. So Bethany clearly became this partly center of operation of part of the New Testament church. The church probably met in Martha's home. We can see that elsewhere in the New Testament. So who were Mary and Martha and Lazarus? They were disciples of Jesus Christ. They were observant Jews doing the best they could to pursue what the scriptures said, or at least what they understood them to say, and they were looking for the Messiah. And they believed that they had found him. They believed Jesus was the Messiah. They may not have understood everything about him being the Son of God, but they certainly believed that he was the Messiah. And what we also come to see is that Jesus enjoyed a very close personal friendship with these three disciples. Now, clearly, Christ loves everyone. But he had a specially close friendship with these three as well. Because on several occasions, it mentions specifically that Jesus loved each of these siblings, which is quite a statement. Now, you find that as well. In your life, there are some people you just attach to more. I mean, we love everybody here. At the same time, there are some that we just bond with. Maybe personalities are similar. Maybe interests are similar. You enjoy their company, and that's fine. Christ had a close personal friendship with these three. And again, with their attitude of kindness and service and dedication, that seemed to be a great mix along the way. So their home in Bethany seems to become this base of operation in this part of the country. So we might assume as well, since there was a house large enough to have large gatherings, they were probably fairly wealthy as well, maybe a prominent family in the area of Bethany. So that gives us a little bit of background about Lazarus and Mary and Martha, at least for a start. Now, I'd like to have you take out your 3x5 card, put it there in John 11. We'll be back in a few minutes. But let's go to John chapter 11 here in verse 2. It says that Mary, who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So again, he's setting the stage. Put your card there. Turn over to Mark chapter 14. So he says, what Lazarus are we talking about? Well, we're talking about the one who has a sister Mary. And which Mary is it? Oh, it's the Mary that actually wiped Christ's feet, or kind of dried his feet, we might say, or spread this ointment on his feet with her hair. And Mark chapter 14 tells us that story. We won't go to it in great detail because we've covered this in the past. But to set the stage again for Lazarus and what's going on here, it's good to take a look at this again. In verse 1 of chapter 14 in Mark, after 2 days, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the chief priests and scribes sought how they might take him, meaning Christ, by trickery, and put him to death. But, they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar of the people. And being in Bethany, remember what John 11 said, Bethany, Lazarus of Bethany, the house or home or city of Mary and Martha. Being in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, he sat at the table. So Christ is sitting down at a dinner party, we might say, at the house of a very prominent man, Simon the leper. Now, whether he was currently a leper or had been in the past and been healed, we're not told. Probably that's the case. As he sat at the table, a woman came. Doesn't tell us who the woman was. We'll learn from the book of John that this is Mary. Remember the one that washed his feet with her hair. She came having an alabaster flask of very costly oil of spikenard. So this oil was so precious that it was sealed inside this stone box with a seal, and that seal had to be broken. The box actually had to be broken. A flask had to be broken so that the oil could be kind of poured out and scooped out. Other of the gospel accounts say it was a box So some feel literally was a box that it was packed in. And it kind of was like the consistency of coconut oil at about 70 degrees, where some of it's liquid. How many of you have coconut oil at home? Okay, it seems to be one of the in things these days. So, you know, coconut oil, you got the, if it's warm, you, some of it pours off the top, and the other's like a cream, like almost a lotion type of thing. Well, that's what this probably was. So it wasn't a full oil that just ran like olive oil might run out of the bottle. So it's this kind of lotiony, oily consistency. But it says here it was very costly. We'll see in a moment how costly. The oil of spikenard, very fragrant. Then she broke the flask and poured it on his head. So the liquid part poured out onto his head. So think, for those who are a little older, Brill Cream, 1955. So it's this greasy kind of oily stuff, but extremely fragrant. And she massaged it into his scalp. And again, did you just have some stranger walk up to you? This woman walks up, let me put this on your head. Well, no. But someone you're very close to, that you love as a friend and as a sister. Yeah, could she do that? Now, some of you ladies, go get your hair done. And when you do, you go to this place, and I've seen this at Fantastic Sam's where I get my hair cut. They got these sinks that are funny shaped. They're real deep, and they've got this scoop in them. And that's where you put your head. So these ladies go there, and they lay back in their chair, and their neck goes in that little scoop thing. And then the barbress or whatever, hairdresser, I guess she's called, she does the washing of the hair before she does all the other things to it, before spraying it full of poisons. And, you know, I'm just kidding. But it just feels so good, doesn't it, to have someone, just wash your hair and you're relaxing. And similar here. Just a very kind thing that she was doing. So what we're trying to illustrate is this close personal relationship that Christ had with these three siblings. There's just a closeness there. So she pours it on his head. And again, the ancients in these days would put oil on their head to keep away bugs and things like that, and this beautiful fragrance. So this oil would have been on his scalp for days, and just this fragrant smell. Frankly, when he was crucified, he probably still could have been smelling some of that beautiful fragrance from this event. Verse 4, there were some who were indignant among themselves. No, they didn't tell Christ this. They were telling each other. Why was this fragrant oil wasted? For it might have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor. And they criticized her sharply. Well, it may not sound like much, but I think we may have covered this before. A denarii was, sometimes translated in the Old King James, a penny, was a day's wage for a common laborer. So to think that this could have been sold for 300 denarii, that's almost a year's worth of the common laborer's wages. So if we were to translate that today, UC Davis Center for Poverty Research says this: the annual earnings in America today for a full-time minimum wage worker, that's $7.25 an hour, is in a year $15,080. Now, let's not look at how could possibly a person survive on that amount of money. Let's look at it in regard to this oil. We're talking about a $15,000 to $20,000 flask of oil. That's precious oil. When it says very costly, that certainly was the case. So obviously, Mary loved Christ so much that she was willing to give this phenomenal gift to him and put it in his hair, and as we'll see from John, also upon his feet. So they were indignant. It might have been sold. So they criticized. Jesus said, let her alone. Why do you trouble her? Here she doing this out of the goodness of her heart. She has done a good work for me. It's okay. For you have the poor with you always. Would that 300 denarii have solved the poverty problem in Israel at the time? Well, of course not. Might have bought a couple people a meal, or maybe a week's worth of meals, but doesn't solve the problem. So that's not to say we don't help the poor. Obviously, we do. Try to show hospitality and kindness. Verse 7, for you have the poor with you always, and whenever you wish, you may do them good. And we should. But me you do not have always. She's done what she could. She has come beforehand to anoint my body for burial. So maybe, just maybe, Mary had a glimmer of understanding of what Christ was going to go through. And if she didn't, Christ was telling them that, look, you misunderstand. I'm going to die. I'm not going to take over the world right now. I'm not going to set up the kingdom at this time. She's done this for my burial. Assuredly, verse 9, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her. So again, this close relationship with Christ that Mary and Martha and Lazarus had. Now, if we go back to the book of John, not to chapter 11, but to chapter 12, one beyond where we have our marker. John chapter 12, in verse 1. And here's John's account. Now, he gives some interesting detail 60 years later, or maybe we're talking 30 maybe or so years after the book of Mark would have been written. So he's filling in details that the other Gospels don't have. So he adds some interesting things about Mary and the oil and the family. 6 days before the Passover, in verse 1, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. So this was already a story of fame in the New Testament church by the time John wrote this. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him, a position of honor. So here is Lazarus. He's a prominent individual. He's right there at the table with Christ. So again, a very close personal relationship with, friendship with Christ and Lazarus and the girls. Verse 3, then Mary took a pound of very costly oil, the oil of spikenard. Pure nard is the way some translations render that. Spikenard is an oil that comes from the nard plant, and it's the spikenard plant. And it's grown in the foothills of the Himalayas in India. So they would have to harvest this. It had to grow wild. They apparently couldn't cultivate it. So they would send people out, and they would harvest this plant, especially the flower tips, and then they would squeeze them and boil them, turn them into this oil, this mixture, very fragrant. Then they would bottle it, or they'd box it, and they would seal it, and then camel caravan it all the way from India through Arabia to the Middle East to the area of Israel and sell it. So no wonder this was so expensive, but extremely fragrant. And it says it's pure nard, so it wasn't mixed with anything. When you buy Jamaican coffee, if you're going to buy real Jamaican coffee and you really want the Jamaican experience, it has to be 100% Blue Mountain coffee. Because if it says Blue Mountain coffee on it, they're lying to you. It has to say 100%, because otherwise they'll take a bean from Jamaica, grind that, and put it with Folgers and say, oh, it's Blue Mountain mixture. You liars. So here we have pure nard. I mean, this is expensive stuff. It's not mixed with anything else. And there's probably a lesson in that as well. We give our very best to Christ. Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus. Now, Mark said anointed her hair. Not true. In this case, both were done. Excuse me for one second. My phone is buzzing, so if you hear that, I'm sorry. I didn't bring my watch today, so I have my phone up here for the clock, and now it's ringing. Hello? Okay. It's going to buzz right here on the... Oh, great. When my grandson hears this, he always says, hello! He has no idea what the phone is yet, but he always says, hello! All right, well, let's let this buzz for a minute, and we'll go on from there. a pound of this oil, anointed the feet of Jesus. So she started at his head, rubbed it through his scalp, and then began to take care of his feet. And again, the feet were often anointed with oil because they walked a lot. Lots of calluses and sores could develop on the feet. So anointing them with oil soothed that, cleaned them in that sense, and protected them. So in one sense, we look at she's anointing his head, she's anointing his feet. And again, it's a very emotional event. Again, you wouldn't normally be sitting somewhere and some strange woman walk up and take your sandals off and put oil on your feet. It'd be pretty odd in our culture. But it was not difficult or unusual in that culture for a servant to do that kind of thing. So she took this pound, anointed his feet, very costly, wiped his feet with her hair. So again, very emotionally, just realizing that something is up. The topics that they were discussing were frightening and scary, and he's going to die, but he's the Messiah, and yet how can this happen? So she's just very involved in this situation. The house, it says, was filled with the fragrance of the oil. There was no Bed Bath and Beyond or Bath and Body Works and places like that where you go in and everything smells like utopia. Things smell badly in this culture. And to have the whole house filled with this beautiful scent would have been delightful. One of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" So it was Simon, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who started this complaining. And it's interesting that he was the bad apple, but what is also interesting is how quickly the others joined in. And one bad apple does spoil the whole bunch. Verse 5, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii, given to the poor? This he said, not that he cared for the poor." Sometimes people can be very deceptive, and Judas had it down. I mean, he was good at this. Coming across very righteous, very superior, but in truth, his heart was somewhere else. He didn't say this because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box and used to take what was put in it. He was an embezzler. He tried to enrich himself. No wonder he sold Christ for 30 pieces of silver. Verse 7, Jesus said, "Let her alone. She has kept this for the day of my burial." So maybe she did understand a bit of what was coming. "The poor," he said, "you have with you always, but me you do not have always." So again, we illustrate this tremendously close relationship that Christ had. And we see a bit of Mary's personality here, this deep dedication to Christ, the desire to serve and to help him. Now, it's interesting that Martha is also mentioned. Turn to Luke chapter 10. Just a bit of background regarding Martha. The reason I like to read this is because Mary and Martha and Lazarus are just like real people. They're not some story out there. Everybody knows a Mary, don't we? That woman is just doesn't quite seem to have her stuff together, but is really a nice lady. You enjoy their company and spending time with them. And everybody knows a Lazarus, who just a great guy to be around, enjoyable company, works hard, probably makes a decent living, just a great guy. And everybody knows a Martha, who is talented, accomplished person, but sometimes just in a snit, you know, just gets a burr under her saddle, at least that's what we used to say, a burr under the saddle makes a horse very uncomfortable, by the way. It makes a horse pretty snippy, and that's what Mary was, or Martha was at times. Luke chapter 10 and verse 38. "Now it happened as they went, he entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house." So in this case, Luke is not relating as much of the personal details as he is the overview. So he doesn't say it's Bethany. He doesn't say much details about it. It's a certain village. He doesn't even say it's Bethany. John and Mark both do that. And a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house, which again would give the indication that she's the oldest of the siblings. This is kind of her house. She's the mom of the bunch, we might say. And of course, when older sisters try to mother younger sisters, sometimes it doesn't work real well. And somehow older sisters sometimes think it's, I have a sister, I mentioned that. Sometimes they think it's their responsibility to make sure that the kids get raised properly, and can cause a little bit of upset here and there. But that's the way Martha seemed to be. Martha welcomed him into her house, and she had a sister called Mary. We already talked about Mary, who sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. Was that a bad thing? No, that was an excellent thing. But as far as Martha was concerned, Mary should have been helping out with all the meal preparations and serving. Verse 40, Martha was distracted with much serving. Martha got things out of perspective. Martha had rules, and these rules needed to be followed exactly as Martha thought they should be. So, what time was the meal going to be served? Martha had it ready. She had the stopwatch running. Okay. The poutine's been cooking for 3 minutes and 40 seconds. There's 20 seconds yet to go, and it must be served. Piping hot. Otherwise, it's not the right thing. She had control. She wanted control. She wasn't a bad person, but it was her personality. This is the way it's to be done because it's the right way, and it needs to be done the way that I do it because it's the right way. And if you don't see it that way, something's clearly wrong with you because obviously this is the right way to do it. So Martha got in a bit of a snit. And sometimes very talented people like Martha, who are extremely good at what they do, can, if they're not careful, cause upset because it has to be my way. This is the way it needs to be done. So Martha was distracted with much serving. She approached him and said, Lord, and I try to picture, how did she say this? I'm guessing it was in short bursts, not just, Lord, do you not care? No, it's, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her what she needs to be doing. Tell her to help me. Jesus answered and said, Martha, chill out. I mean, he didn't use those words, but that's what he's saying. It doesn't have to be done your way. Look, if dinner is at 4:30 instead of 4, it's okay, we're going to eat. Just relax. Doesn't have to be that structured. You're making enemies here. You got everybody in the kitchen already upset, and you're banging pots and pans around there like this is the only thing that can be done. I'm going to let you know that you're not doing it my way, and this is upsetting to me. And you're obviously wrong because you're not agreeing with my set of rules. Martha, Martha, you're worried and troubled about many things. Relax. There is one thing is needed, and Mary has chosen that good part which shall not be taken away from her. So relax. So was Martha a bad woman? No, extremely talented woman. Her home becomes this refuge for the church of God, for the people. Tremendously talented woman. And yet, not done her way. She learned a lot, I'm sure, from this interaction with Christ. And it probably helped her a great deal to understand that it's not the job that is the most important. It's the people that are the most important. And if you get it done your way and everybody's mad and doesn't want to be anywhere near you, whoa, have we really accomplished anything? Well, no, we've made it worse in some respects. So Mary's chosen the right thing. Relax. Dinner will be fine. If we have to eat lukewarm poutine, it'll be okay. Steaming hot's better, but, you know, lukewarm's okay. We'll be fine. So that's the dynamic we're working with. So you have Martha, this organized and sharp and attentive woman. And you've got Mary, just this lovable younger lady, and you got Lazarus in the middle. And I'm sure at times Lazarus was trying to balance his sisters. Martha, calm down. Mary, would you do this and help out? Come on. So he may be in the middle of all this. Christ just loved this family, loved being around them. They were enjoyable company. So let's go back to John chapter 11. See what lessons you're starting to jot down already. John chapter 11 and verse 1 again. Now a certain man was sick. The word sick there and in verse 2 means to be feeble, to be diseased, to be made weak. More times than it's translated sick, the word is translated weak. Just this, something came over Lazarus where formerly energetic and hardworking, and he just lost it and just drained of all this. He is really, really sick. Verse 2, it was that Mary, as you know, a town of Bethany, Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary whom anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped her feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So John is setting the stage and setting the story there, so we have context to it all. Verse 3, therefore, the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. So specific, John makes a specific statement about how Christ really loved Lazarus. He just enjoyed his company. It was a great match, or however it worked. Their personalities just meshed, and he really loved spending time with him. But how sick was Lazarus? I mean, for the sisters to send special courier to Christ, he was really sick. I mean, this was desperation time. Desperately sick. Now, they knew that Jesus healed people. They'd seen it themselves, most likely. They'd heard all the stories. They knew that Christ could heal their brother. And so they sent to him saying, would you please come and anoint him, lay hands on him, and heal him. The one whom you love is sick. Not just anybody out here. This is one of those people you really love. Verse 4. When Jesus heard, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now you all know that Lazarus died. So what did Christ mean when he said, this sickness is not unto death? He died. I think it's cleared up clearly in the translation. Something like the New American Standard says it this way. But when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness is not to end in death. Now, he died temporarily, as we all know, but that wouldn't be the end of it all. It's not going to end in death. There'll be another sickness later on that will end in death. And Lazarus did experience that. And he is dead now. He's not still out there walking around. He is dead, but this is not going to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it or through it, as the New King James says. So Lazarus was extremely sick, and the girls are reaching out to their friend and the one they know is the Messiah, asking for him to come and heal their brother. Now think about that as we go through. What were Mary and Martha thinking during this time? Now, verse 5, John also makes a statement. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So even though Mary was a little bit maybe irresponsible and Martha was maybe a little bit too controlling and rule-oriented and snippy sometimes, he really loved these people. Just loved being around them, loved spending time. He loved them. John makes a special note to make sure we understand that. Verse 6. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. Interesting. Christ knew he was sick, didn't do anything. At least to the common observer, Christ did nothing. Now it's interesting because a little bit later on, when Martha is talking to Christ, he asks for the tomb to be open. He says, Lazarus has been already dead 4 days, or in the tomb at least 4 days. Could have been dead more than that. So it may be that that Lazarus has already died. Doesn't seem to be that way. But he sat for 2 days, did nothing. Now again, you ask yourself, well, how far was Bethany from Jerusalem, where Christ may have been? Well, it's a couple miles, 2 miles. 2 miles, how fast can you walk? Well, most people, if they're walking a pretty good clip, might walk 6 miles an hour. Christ could have been there in 30 minutes, easily. 30-year-old carpenter could have been there probably quicker than that if he wanted to. Could have been there, but he didn't go. Stayed for 2 more days in the place where he was. That might teach us some things. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and you're going there again?" So the indication is he may have been back up in Galilee, not in Judea. So it could have been a day's trip, maybe, to get down to where Bethany was. Nonetheless, could have easily made it in time. Chose not to go. The disciples, "Jews want to stone you, you're going to go there again?" Jesus said, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night," so 12 hours in the day, 12 hours in the night, "he stumbles because the light is not in him." So don't worry about that. Follow the light, you'll be fine. Verse 11, "These things he said, and after that he said to them, 'Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up.'" So Christ already knew that Lazarus was dead. The disciples said, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get well." What do doctors recommend when you're sick? Rest. Oftentimes, that's one of the solutions. Rest. Boy, if he's fallen into a deep sleep, that's great. He's going to get better. His body's going to heal. However, verse 13, Jesus spoke of his death. But they thought that he was speaking about taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus said to them plainly, "No, Lazarus is dead." Now, didn't he just say a couple days before that this sickness was not to end in death? So they're probably confused at this point. "Lazarus is dead, and for your sakes, I am glad that I was not there, that you may believe." In other words, God had a plan involved here. He had a routine that he was going to take them through for their spiritual education. So he says, "Nevertheless, let us go to him." Let us go to him. Time to go. Goes on to say in verse 16, "Thomas, who is called the twin, said to his fellow disciples." Did you remember that Thomas was very likely a twin? That's why he was called the twin. I grew up with a set of twins, some of my best friends. Now, their names were Tim and Jim, but we never called them Tim and Jim. We called them the twins, because that's what you do when you have twins and they're good friends. They're the twins. I don't know that we ever, unless we happened to be with one of them by themselves, that we called them by their first name. It was the twins, because they were always together. Thomas was a twin. Now, maybe the twins were very much alike. Now, Thomas, usually we think of Thomas as Thomas. What adjective do we put before his name? Doubting Thomas. Well, in this case, he shows a great deal of courage. So maybe we think of him from here on out as Thomas the twin. And his brother's name, I think, was Billy the Believer. Very different than Thomas. I don't know. We're not told what his twin's name was. But normally, if it's Thomas, then it's probably Tim, or, you know, Timmy and Tommy, you know, that kind of thing. When you have twins, people tend to name them very similar like that, Billy and Bobby. My buddies growing up were Tim and Jim. So Tim and Jim Matthias, the twins. So Thomas says, "Let us go that we may die with him." Tremendous faith at this point. Okay, if this is it, it's time to die. Okay, here we go. Verse 17, "When Jesus came, he found that he already been in the tomb 4 days." So he may have been dead 5 or 6 days by this time. But he'd been in the tomb 4 days. Now, it's normally done very quickly after death. So 4, maybe 5 days that Lazarus had already been dead. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. So again, pretty prominent family, lots of people there helping in the mourning of the situation. Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went out and met him. So she left the city, went outside the city to meet Christ on the way. But Mary was sitting in the house. Now Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died." Oh, we can learn something about Martha's faith. It was incomplete, clearly. It was incomplete. She assumed that for Lazarus to be healed, Jesus had to be there in person. "If you would have been here, my brother would not have died." Now, in one sense, that's also a statement of faith, that I believe you are the Messiah and you could heal. Verse 22, "But even now, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Now, again, I don't make much sense out of Martha's statement. I'm not sure what she meant by that. It'd be fun to find out one day what exactly she had in mind when she said that. In other words, was she saying, "Look, even though you didn't take care of this situation, I know that you have a contact with God. Whatever you ask Him, He'll give you. You didn't do it in this situation, but I trust that you are that person. You have that relationship with God." Jesus said to her again, or said to her, I should say, "Your brother will rise again." Now, Martha clearly was not under the influence of the Sadducees, because the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. But influenced, no doubt, by the Pharisees, and general understanding was that there will be a resurrection. Martha knew that. Verse 24, Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." That's more than 99% of Protestants understand today. It's true. She knew that. And there was not common or not uncommon Jewish understanding at the time. "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, shall live. Whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" Now that was a mouthful. Christ was saying, "I have the power over death." She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ." In other words, "I'm not quite sure what you just said, but what I do know is that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world." Now, what the rest of that means, I'm just not sure. So Mary and Martha and Lazarus believed that Christ was the Messiah, and literally here saying the Son of God, the Christ, the Anointed. They knew that he had power from God. They may have understood that he was the Son of God in the literal term as opposed to the figurative understanding of that. Verse 28, "And when she had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary her sister, saying, 'The teacher has come and is calling for you.' And as soon as she heard that, she arose quickly." She ran out the door and came to him. And Jesus had not yet come into the town, but was out in the place where Martha met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, "She is going to the tomb to weep there." Now again, maybe they were following her for the right reasons and going to support her in the midst of the grief that she was in. We don't know that for sure, whether they were sincere or not, but nonetheless, they followed her out. "Then when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him the same exact words that Martha had said, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.' Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled." Now, we're not told what went on in Christ's mind at that point, and we've speculated over the years, what was it that he was groaning about? Was he truly saddened by their grief because of the loss? That's certainly possible. Was he troubled because they really didn't grasp his power, who he was? that he can fix this, that he can exercise power over death, that somehow he had failed because he didn't come soon enough? Did they really think that? Is their understanding so shallow? Maybe a combination of all those things. And he said, verse 34, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see," over this way. So they led him there. Jesus, says verse 35, wept. And again, we're not told why he wept. Was it the factors we just talked about? Was he truly saddened to see the grief that they were going through? Lack of understanding, maybe even some hypocrisy by those who were following along, we're just not told. Christ felt deep emotion, no doubt, and he wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." Now, sometimes people weep at funerals because of that deep love. In this case, that may not be the whole story, because Christ had power over it. He knew what was going to happen, so he's probably weeping about other things. Verse 37, "Some of them said, 'Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?'" And of course the answer is yes. He very easily could have done that, without a doubt. But they were doing it as a criticism. He couldn't do it? He could heal blind men, but couldn't keep this man from dying? Well, again, Jesus groaning again in himself, certainly for the lack of faith, the lack of their understanding, their disbelief in some respects, groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, "Take away the stone." But Martha, the rules girl, the "this is the way you do it" girl, Martha said, the sister of him who was dead, said, "Lord, by this time there's a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?" So he must have kind of burned a hole in Martha at this point. Looked her straight in the eye. "Man, Martha, didn't I say this?" She didn't object from that point onward. They took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me." This was all arranged in advance. Not that you are listening to me now. This was all arranged. He gets the news that Lazarus was sick. And in my judgment, God allowed that sickness at that time for the events that would lead up to Christ's crucifixion. "I thank you that you've heard me." This would be the event that would lead directly to Christ's crucifixion. "And I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me." So the only reason he's praying out loud is so that everybody knows he's in contact with the Father. This has all been set up in advance, and this is what's going to take place. God is directly involved here. This is the Son of God. This is the Christ. It is the Messiah who's going to take care of this. Verse 43. "Now when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come forth!' And he who had died came out, bound hand and foot with grave cloths." So it's kind of like the Mummy movie, only a good mummy, not evil demonic things. He came out, bound hand and foot with grave cloths, and his face was wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to him, "Loose him and let him go." Somebody untie him. I mean, they're all standing there just in awe, watching this guy stumble out of the tomb, and they can't believe it. Well, unwrap him. Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary. And that's an interesting thing. The way John writes that. Many of the Jews who had come to Mary. Mary, remember that younger sister? Mary must have been an extremely personable individual. I think, personally, everybody liked Mary. She just had that kind of personality. It was whatever it was. Didn't say they came to help Martha, although they kind of did, but Martha's a little prickly, so Mary's the one that they came to. They'd come to Mary and seen the things which Jesus did, believed in him. Some of them went away, of course, to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. Now, you know the rest of the story there. This was then the event that said, "We have got to kill this man. Because if we allow this to take place, more and more people are going to follow Him. They're not going to follow us. The Romans are going to come and take away our position and destroy our nation. So what was most important to the religious leaders was their position, not the nation. But that was on second on the list. Yeah, the nation, them too. So we ask the question, what might we learn? Maybe you've already jotted down some lessons as you went through the story. I'll jot down, or I'll at least list for you the things that jumped out to me in this time studying through this story, this event. And the first one was this. We tend to both limit and blame God. We tend, if we're not careful, to both limit and blame God. Remember Martha when she met Christ, when He was coming during the time of mourning? Lord, if You had been here, my brother would not have died. Mary, Lord, if You had been here, my brother would not have died. This was limiting God. If you turn with me to Psalm 78. Psalm 78. Both Mary and Martha limited God. They had made the determination in their mind that if Christ was not there personally, He did not have the power to heal Lazarus. Now, you have grown past that understanding because you have probably requested anointings when the minister could not personally be there. And so He sent an anointed cloth, and you've understood God's not limited by proximity. That's not an issue with God at all. But for the girls, they didn't understand that at this point. They limited God. He can't fix this unless He's there. Psalm 78 in verses 40 to 42 shows how Israel limited God. Limiting God, brethren, is actually a sin. It's something we don't want to do. We don't want to find ourselves doubting that God can do what He clearly has the power and ability to do. Psalm 78 and verse 40, how often they provoked Him in the wilderness and grieved Him in the desert. Yes, again and again they tempted God, and so the tempting and provoking is a couple set of sins, but also limited the Holy One of Israel. They limited the Holy One of Israel, Psalm 78, verse 41. They did not remember His power, the day when He redeemed them from the enemy. So, what did Israel do? Well, God can't give us food out here in the middle of the desert. He's obviously brought us out here to die. There's no water. There's no meat. There's no food. Now, who sprung them from the Egyptians and poured out these 10 plagues? They forgot the power of God. So, brethren, we tend, if we're not careful, to limit God. That God is not able to do these things. Well, maybe we don't actually say those words, but we kind of think that. You know, it would take for this to be solved. God isn't interested. Yet the girls also tended to blame God. If you had been here. Again, put yourself back in the shoes of Mary and Martha. Their brother is deathly ill. And they said, well, what should we do? We've tried everything. Well, we need to get a hold of Jesus. He can heal him. So they send messengers. Day one goes by. Day two goes by. Lazarus. What are they thinking at this point? What would we be thinking in that circumstance? Where is God? Why isn't He answering in the way obviously He should be? Think Mary and Martha were thinking those kinds of thoughts? I think they probably would have. Day four, do you think there's a bit of disappointment there in Mary and Martha's hearts? Like, why didn't He come? Why did He let us down? Why is it being done this way? They tended to blame Christ. If You just would have come, He wouldn't be dead. It's a common human question. We start at about age 1.5 or 2. Why? Why? We'll talk about this next month in our Friday Night Live Bible study, Principles of Parenting. Parents don't have to answer the why question. We'll talk about that, why that's important. Why? Time to go to bed. Why? I'm not going to answer that question. Go to bed. It's not time to answer a question. Not time to ask a question. Go to bed. Time to go to bed. Time to brush your teeth. Why? Well, see, if we as parents... I shouldn't get off on this. Well, we brush our teeth because if we don't brush our teeth, you can get cavities. And this child should be brushing their teeth. They shouldn't be answering, listening to mom and dad's answer about this. That's a different time of education. Why do we brush teeth? Not at the time you're asking them to brush their teeth. Time to do this. Nonetheless, in this case, we ask. Martha asked in her mind, where were you? Why didn't you come? If you had been here, Lazarus would be alive. Tend to blame God. Kind of somewhat reminiscent of God confronting Adam. And he says, the woman you gave me. It's not my fault. It's the woman you gave me. She offered me the fruit and I took it. What was the truth? I didn't want to listen to you. I want to do it myself. But it's the woman you gave me. He says, God, it's really your fault. If you hadn't given me this woman, I wouldn't have sinned because I wouldn't have been, yes, you would have. So we tend to both limit and blame God. And that's something that we as Christians want to be aware of, that we don't do. And that leads me to the second point that I think was helpful for me, at least. God's perspective is better than ours. God's perspective is better than ours. We could also say God's perspective is more complete than ours. God's perspective is thorough or full, and ours is partial. Lots of ways we could say that. God's perspective is better than ours. Turn to Psalm 53. Psalm 53. As you're turning there, verses 2 and 3. Turning to Psalm 53, I'll relate a program I saw bits and pieces of a few years ago. And it had to do with these amazing sculptures or designs that are kind of carved into the earth's surface on a mammoth scale. Some of these are in Central America, some are in South America, some other parts of the world. But you're walking through the jungle, and basically it looks like this is an open path area that's maybe 20 or 30 feet wide. And you have no idea what this is. But then as soon as you get up above that in a balloon or an airplane, you see this massive sculpture that's hundreds and hundreds of feet long and wide. And it might be a spider. And there's this eight-legged spider in perfect proportion, hundreds of feet long. And it's got this perfectly oblong center, the body. And then another oblong section which represents the other part of the body. And then these eight legs in perfect symmetry, hundreds of feet long. And of course, you're in the jungle, you have no idea what this is. All I see is a small little piece of open jungle. But when you get up above, you see this complex design. Now, of course, some people, based on that, said ancient people are way too stupid to have figured out how to do this. So it's clear that aliens came and built these designs on these plateaus or in the jungle to mark their landing spots, where they pick up their supplies and... Oh, shut up. Yeah, these ancient people built pyramids that we still cannot equal. And the aliens built those too. Point is, when you're on the ground, you cannot see the overall design. And that's what David, in one sense, says here in Psalm 53, verse 2. God looks down from heaven upon the children of men. Pause there for a second. Like these designs, until you get a view from above, you cannot make sense of it. Don't know what it means, what it looks like, how large it might be until you get up above it. God has a perspective that is far superior to ours because he has the overview. He knows what the goal is. In this case, the resurrection of Lazarus was a goal that nobody understood. Nobody. They sent a message, Lazarus is going to die. If you don't come and heal him, he doesn't go. Why? Because he saw that, well, this has to do with my crucifixion. We've got to have an event that these religious leaders get so upset about that the wheels to the crucifixion have to turn, and at the exact right time, so that I am crucified at the exact right time on the Passover day. And I'm put into the tomb before sunset, or right at sunset on that day, on that Wednesday, prior to the Holy Day. And it was all timed out perfectly. Many times we only see the kind of path there, and it doesn't make sense to us. God looks down from heaven upon the children of men. Ever been on an airplane? Get that aisle seat sometimes, but sometimes you get that window seat. And it's just awesome. Especially the greatest time to sit at the window is at night. Just to take off as it's getting dark, and you see these amazing sights. And it automatically changes your perspective. I don't know any Christian that doesn't fly on an airplane and say, wow, God is just so cool, so amazing. To think that he sees this all the time, how small we are, how insignificant we are compared to God. God's perspective is better than ours. He knows what the end game is, what the end story is, what the end accomplishment is. We don't. And we may never know in this physical life the reason for lots of different things. But God's perspective is perfect. He has the end game. He knows what the end is. It's going to be great. So no matter what kind of suffering we may go through in the meantime, God's perspective is better than ours. This is where faith comes in. That's one of the reasons I think Christ said, Martha, do you really believe? Do you have faith? Do you believe I am the resurrection and the life? Do you believe those things? He asked his brother, do you believe that? Do we believe when bad things happen, God has an end game in mind? I hope we do. God said to Samuel, you know, Samuel, don't look on the physical things. Don't look on the appearance. Stature, this man, I've not chosen him. He's not the one. You look on the outward appearance. You look on the outward appearance because it's all you can do. I look at the heart. God has an end game in mind for all. His perspective is better than ours. I've also learned, number three, God will act in his way. God decides. Now, I can try to influence God. I can try to convince God of what I think is best. And we all do. In our prayers, we probably tell God, this is what seems to be the answer. This is what seems to be best. This is what I think is best. But you, as we all know, you do as you see fit because your judgment is perfect. God will act in his way, and often he acts in ways we are not able to guess. Ways we're not able to guess. Turn to Isaiah 55. Isaiah 55 and verse 6. This scripture probably came to mind when I mentioned that. Isaiah 55, verses 6 through 9. God will act in his way, and that is the perfect way. It is the way that is best for us. And again, that issue is an issue of faith. Isaiah 55, verse 6, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. And we do that, don't we, as family members, as Christians. Let the wicked forsake his ways. We have to do that. Let the unrighteous man his thoughts. We have to do that. Let him return to the Lord. That's our effort. He will have mercy on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. That's always very comforting. Verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts. He's not necessarily being critical. It's just the way it is. You don't see the overview. You don't understand all the details of the end game. You don't know where I want you and my family, so you won't grasp these things. My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. For as, verse 9, the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Now, certainly he's in one sense talking about the carnal and unconverted mind, being so totally opposite of God's. But it's also true of the converted mind, that we're only learning. got so much growth to do. God will act in His way, and it's up to us to, in faith, know that He always has our best interests in mind. He has the end game. So yes, sometimes Lazarus dies and needs to be resurrected. And Christ will take care of that. So I've also learned, number four, that God works on multiple levels simultaneously. God works on multiple levels simultaneously. Now, I have a computer that sits on my desk, and it's always amazing to me how many things are going on in that machine simultaneously that I have no idea about. I mean, it's checking to see if there's updates for various programs, and all of a sudden something pops up. There's an update for such and such a program. Well, did I ask you for an update? No. But it's already running in the background. So every time you turn the computer on, it checks the date, checks the time, and then checks, well, that's why I have to check, and all these things going on. So I can be sending emails while I'm typing on a word processing program, and all this is happening at once. Take that and multiply it by about 1.5 billion, and you get a little bit of what God is like. He's working with each of these individuals. Was Christ working with Lazarus? Well, yeah. Do you think Lazarus, as he's laying there, sick as a dog, you don't think he asked certain questions of God? Why am I sick? I mean, I've been a picture of health. I'm 35 years old or whatever. I'm guessing he was pretty near the age of Christ. And his siblings were probably near this age, late 20s, early 30s. I mean, it's too early to die. I got my sisters to take care of. What? You think he'd ask those kind of questions? Well, of course. God's working with him, developing faith in him, trust in him. Well, then you got the girls. Don't think Mary asked the question? Well, I thought you loved us. I thought surely if we asked you to, if I asked you to come, you would come. Surely you would do that. Don't think Martha asked questions? We sent the message 2 days ago. He hasn't come yet. Did she ask those kind of questions? I thought he really cared about us. I thought he really would take the time out of his schedule to come see us. Why is this happening? What's going on? So he's working with Mary. He's working with Martha. Working with Lazarus. Each with their own needs through this circumstance. He was working with the disciples. Working with those outside the group of the disciples. So he prays out loud at this gravesite for the benefit of the disciples around. That they would hear and they would know that this is God's doing. He's working with the religious leaders. He's now, because of this resurrection, he instills such fear in the religious leaders that if we don't kill him now, he's going to take over everything. We're going to lose our place. And the Romans will come in as well. So he's dealing with the religious leaders. And interestingly enough, when this was going on, he was dealing with you and me. Because this story would be recorded for posterity's sake, so that you and I can grow spiritually by reading this story. So God is able to work on all these multiple levels all at once, simultaneously, reading our needs and what we need to grow in and working with us in that. So God is a pretty amazing God. Last but not least, we'll quit. The other thing that I jotted down is that Lazarus is a grand allegory. Lazarus is a grand allegory. Now, there are those who simply believe it's a story. It didn't really happen. It's a fiction. It's designed to be an allegory that teaches certain lessons. Not an analogy, but an allegory. In other words, in an allegory, each of these things represents something different than it actually is. But it teaches a life lesson or a life story. So it is true that Lazarus is an allegory, but it was an actual happening that is also an allegory of types. Lazarus represents us. We are dead in sin prior to the Messiah resurrecting us. And when you come up out of the waters of baptism, you, all like Lazarus, come out of the grave to a new life. So in one sense, yeah, it's an interesting allegory. But it's a real life happening. These were real people. It's really happened to them. But we were dead in sin. We required the intervention of the Savior. We were put under the waters of baptism like Lazarus was put in the grave, and we come out a new person. The resurrection is the hope of the dead. So in that sense, it's an interesting allegory as well. Multiple levels at multiple times. Brethren, the life of Lazarus, of Mary, and Martha is a fascinating study. It is there not just to recount a piece of history, but to teach us vital and important spiritual lessons. Through the lives of Lazarus and Mary and Martha, let us turn to God in faith, learn the lessons that this story might provide, knowing that God is in charge and He is working in us a great salvation.